Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating, and so on. Coming up on this week's episode, we're going to talk about Batesian mimicry, which is where an animal, and lots of different types of animals do this, pretends to be a vicious animal when it's not. And we see this in flies, we see this in birds, we see this in mammals. We're going to be talking about why they do this and why some are more successful than others. Really, really interesting work. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. First, though, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Shelley Brady, who's from the Insight Centre in DCU, and Owen Murphy, science communicator. You're both very welcome. Our first story has to do with bees.
Yeah, this is a sad one, Jonathan, I'm afraid. So scientists are again sounding the alarm on behalf of nature. Across the US, beekeepers are facing catastrophic losses, the worst on record, with over half of 60% of their honeybee colonies have been wiped out in just one season. And as we know, this isn't just about honey. It's about crops that rely on pollinators to grow. And we owe one in every three bites of food to bees. So what happens when they stop showing up? It's all due to what researchers are calling a deadly mix of the stress cocktail, which includes climate change, neurotoxic pesticides, and habitat loss from massive monocrops, all of which is weakening bees and allowing disease to take hold, as well as the fact that these parasites have become completely pesticide resistant. So they're spreading viral infections at a rate of knots. And honeybees are very much acting as the canary in the coal mine in this instance, with wild bees also on the line, revealing widespread threats to wild pollinators and crop health. And even though the US is feeling it the hardest right now, the same story is playing out all over the world, so it really is threatening the stability of our food systems.
Talk to me about this specific study and what it tells us about the recent rapid decline of bees.
Yeah, so again, it's what the science is showing us. It's not just a bee problem, it's a system problem. Very much a warning sign of how modern agriculture might be pushing the natural world too far.
How do you prove something like that, though? Because obviously that sounds intuitively obvious, right? But how do you prove that? And what do they go about looking at to try and prove that monocultures, climate change and neurotoxins are the problem?
Well, what they're saying is it's the fact that there's this 60% loss, right? So the honeybees colonies have been wiped out. It's costing, in the US, that industry over 600 million. And what they're saying is exactly, I don't think they're able to prove it's one particular thing, but they are showing that the bees are weakening, diseases are taking hold, and it's not because of one thing, it's because of the way that they are being farmed. And it's grim, there's no sugarcoating it. It's clear that this chemical overload is backfiring, it's a vicious cycle that's no longer working. But while this is deeply worrying, the thing is, I suppose, and what these scientists are trying to do is make it a moment to rethink how we farm, how we regulate, how we're supporting life on the planet, because many of the same chemicals that are linked to this pollinator collapse have serious health implications for humans too. So there is action, and it's already happening in some places, which, even though there's not really a silver lining, and a lot of this damage can't be undone, some of the farming and the bees, it can all be strengthened again.
Right. In the traditional mindset, the European Union tends to be a little bit more heavy on the regulation when it comes to, harmful substances. And I would imagine we are probably a little bit further ahead than the United States when it comes to regulating the sort of pesticides that are being used. When you say the United States are suffering this the most, are they rapidly introducing legislation? Because I imagine that's not a very Trump thing to do. What is happening on the ground in America to try and prevent total collapse of the bee populations there?
So they've bee-friendly farming programs in place. So they're providing guidelines and certification kind of based on people setting aside forage, nesting sites, clean water, and using responsible pest control. Policy is catching up slowly. So there's local governments, there's pockets, sometimes just individual cities. They're restricting pesticide use and they're even handing out fines. Or FK Junior is actually calling for much tighter pesticide rules at the moment. So I was reading up on him, and he's looking for much greater accountability from the agrichemical industry. So it's quite controversial. It's very political, but it is raising awareness in ways that haven't been seen in a long time in the US.
What is that phrase? Even a stop clock tells the right time twice a day.
Exactly.
But in the EU, how are we dealing with it?
Yeah, in the EU, I suppose what they've shown is that there's like organic farmers, right? They're already leading the way by avoiding synthetic pesticides altogether. There's been studies showing that clusters of organic farms together help reduce pesticide. Of course it does, because you're looking at natural pest predators moving across fields. We're not doing too badly in Ireland in terms of the bee situation. It's bittersweet. Managed hives are doing okay, but the wild bees are in trouble. So there are more programs here. The All-Ireland Pollinator Plan, it's doing quite well. 75% of that has already been implemented. And you see communities mobilizing. So there's a festival last month in Laois called the Wild Bee Festival. You see citizen science school programs. There's actions within councils where you see those wild meadows growing and the no-mo. So yeah, there is momentum, but obviously it's not quite enough.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Thanks very much for that one, Shelley. All right. And Owen, from one sad story to another, this has to do with glaciers, which we all know are under serious threat.
Yes, Jonathan. When I saw the headline for this story, it struck me, first of all, that it looked like the beginning of a blockbuster disaster movie. But unfortunately, what we're seeing is another potential consequence of climate change. So for most of us, when we think about volcanoes, we think of them as something in a faraway land, exotic, almost a tourist attraction. We think about melting ice and maybe the consequences, rising sea levels, loss of habitat, maybe even change of weather patterns. But I myself would never connect them two together.
No.
So what
you think of volcanoes as, you know, tectonic plates and, you know, the sort of large scale movement over long periods of time.
Absolutely. And what this study found is that they presented at a geochemistry conference earlier this week in Prague. They found that the loss of ice from glaciers and peaks on mountains was actually releasing the pressure on underground magma. And what this was doing is that it was making eruptions more likely.
God.
So, you know, we've seen in recent years, specifically, I suppose, the last 2 years, Iceland has been quite volcanically active.
Yeah.
Now, Iceland is a unique case in itself because it's an island which is over a mid-Atlantic kind of ridge there. So they have their own thing. But they are seeing a huge amount of ice loss there. And that's already been seen that they're associating this loss of ice with the increased volcanic activity. But what this study did was they went to Chile. And what they saw for the first time, this study showed that there's an increase in volcanic activity on a continent.
Right.
Past and after the last ice age had ended.
Right.
So to break it down, what they did was they went to the Andes, they camped out high up in the mountains, they went to active and dormant volcanoes, and they based themselves on this twin volcano called Mochochochuenco.
They've got some great names over there, yeah.
That is a very nice one, okay? So they collected data using radioisotope dating on it. So they could estimate the age of the volcanic rock, which was being produced before, during, and after the last ice age. Now, just to kind of bring some numbers into it, the last ice age is approximately 11,500 years ago. So what they saw was that between 26,000 and 18,000 years ago, so before the end of the last ice age, they actually saw that there was this thick ice cover in Chile on the Andes, and it was suppressing the volume of the eruptions. Now, as you approach the end of the last ice age, about 13,000 years ago, there wasn't as much ice. So up to that point, there'd been about a kind of a build-up, maybe 10 to 15 kilometres below the Earth, this pressure.
Yeah.
And as we got close to the end of the last ice age, it started to erupt,
yeah.
Violently erupt. Now, for the first time to see this, they're saying that, well, before what they saw in Iceland, they thought was maybe a unique case. But what they're saying now is that what happened there could happen in North America, could happen in Russia, could happen in New Zealand.
Yeah.
And not only that, in Antarctica, there's over 100 active volcanoes under the ice there.
Oh, my God. So, I mean, it does sound like it's quite early research. So, you know, it's not certainly not a cause to panic, but it's not something I'd ever really considered, that volcanic eruptions might be more prevalent due to climate change because of the pressure of the ice. Our third story, Shelley, has to do with being cool in a different way.
Yeah. So when you think about the word cool, Jonathan, does anyone in particular come to the forefront of your mind?
Carl Sagan was pretty cool.
Okay, good. Because when I started to think about it, I realised I'd never really thought about it But I think the coolest person I ever knew was my Aunt Lily, who lived to be 101 years of age, and she was just so cool. And I'm not sure many other people would consider a 101-year-old to be the coolest person they know. So
that might say more about you than it says about a 101-year-old.
And my company. But do we all have our own definition of the word cool, or what cool is? Well, a new study suggests that we might actually agree more than we think. So between 2018 and 2022, 6,000 adult participants took part across 13 countries. And what the researchers did was they asked people to think of someone cool, not cool, good or not good. And then they rated them on personality and values. And using this data, the researchers assessed how cool people differ from uncool and good people. And in spite of cultural variations, what they found was they were able to identify cool people universally. And they were perceived with six traits. So being more extroverted, hedonistic, powerful, adventurous, open and autonomous. And while there were overlapping traits, being cool isn't the same as being good. So the study highlighted, sorry, go on.
No, I was laughing. I was thinking that very much so. I mean, I would have thought that good is very much not necessarily overlapping with cool.
But being cool, yeah. And I was asking my daughter that today. It's like, who's cool and who's good? And she had very clear ideas of who was good and who was cool. And it was very interesting. But no, it did show that there were overlapping traits between the two. But what it highlighted that were good people are kind, calm and traditional. But cool people often challenge norms. They're not saints. They break the rules in just the right way. So the researchers talked about the concept of coolness when it started back in small rebellious subcultures like black jazz musicians in the 1940s and the beatniks in the 1950s.
Yeah.
But the cool code holds true across the world, apparently. So even when you're looking at the definition of a cool person in Eastern and Western social circles, it seems to be identical.
Yeah. Cool used to mean in the States, I think for a while, was do they smoke weed? You know, yeah. Is this person cool? You know, that's what people would ask each other in the 1970s, I think. I would say, is this guy cool? And what they meant, I think, is that, you know, does this guy smoke weed? So the association with hedonism, I think, is an obvious one. Nothing to do. They didn't ask anything about like clothing or political affiliation.
It didn't show any of the questions, interestingly. It just gave us sort of a summary of, right, of what people consider to be cool. But in short, I suppose cool people were shown to lead the charge in how society shift and grow.
Yeah. And I mean, cool is actually a really interesting thing to study because it's actually very difficult to nail down. Like when you think of Stanley Cups, right? The Stanley Cup is enormous. It's absolutely enormous. We already had large water flasks. How did the Stanley Cup become cool? That is a really interesting question. I mean, is it like, and you know, Malcolm Gladwell tried to address it in The Tipping Point. I think he got some of the stuff right and some of the stuff wrong, but really interesting stories nonetheless. It's really interesting to think about how something like that becomes cool.
It is.
Okay, Owen, our final story very quickly has to do with owning dogs.
Jonathan, would you consider yourself a pet person?
I wouldn't until we got our dog, Roxy, and now very much so.
Okay, so my next question would have been bird, cat, dog or fish. Which one would you pick?
Dog, yeah, dog okay. For sure.
Good, okay. So you're actually already on track to having pretty good brain in older life, by the sounds of it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it seems that way because we all know, and it's been well documented, that having a pet is good for emotional and even physical activity and physical health. But what this recent study has shown is that your selection of pet can play an important role in the rate of cognitive decline you'll experience in old age.
Oh, wow.
So which ones would you think of those four I listed would be the best as a pet?
I'd say a dog and the fish would be the worst, I would have thought. I would say it would go in order, dog, then bird, then cat, then fish. I think cats are not as a dog person. I would think.
Yeah, well, you're right with the dog, wrong with the cat.
Cat's
so
second.
What they, yeah, and cat second. And what they found was that dogs and cats, they're the ones you want.
Right.
Fish, birds, no effect.
Right, okay.
No effect whatsoever. But what they did in this study was they actually looked at the age cohort of 50 or over. Okay, and they did a huge longitudinal study based between 2004 up to 2022, examined 16,500 people all across Europe.
Wow, that's a lot.
It is a huge, and they looked at three areas. They found that pet ownership and cognitive decline was the first thing. So they found that cats and dogs slowed it down, way down.
Wow.
Okay, then they found also that the age cohorts within that over 50 group, it made no difference.
Okay.
No difference. So the older and younger, there was no change.
Okay. So there's a real, I mean, there seems to be whether, you know, it's hard to figure out what the exact link is, but, you know, I guess when you look at loneliness, that is often associated with faster cognitive decline. If you have an animal to talk to, look after, care for, go out to the shops and not stay in bed all day, yeah, that kind of makes sense in a way. Yeah.
But, and they speculate that the actual birds and fish not having any kind of, you know, association with this slowing of cognitive decline is that they don't live as long. You don't develop that connection with them.
And you don't have to take a fish for a walk. Or if you do, it'll be a very short walk. Owen and Shelley, thank you very much. All right, on the way. Why are some species better at fooling predators than others? Stay with us. Now, the extraordinary lengths that creatures will go to thrive and survive through evolutionary adaptation never ceases to amaze me, and particularly when it comes to camouflage and mimicry. There are lots of species on this planet that have found really interesting hacks to try and stay alive. Here to tell us a little bit about Batesian mimicry is Dr. Tom Reeder. He's an evolutionary and behavioural ecologist at the University of Nottingham. Welcome to the programme, Tom.
Hi, Jonathan. Nice to be with you.
So before we talk about Batesian mimicry, maybe you might first sort of give us a rundown of this particular evolutionary trait, mimicry in nature. What exactly are we talking about?
So mimicry, I guess, is a general term for when one organism resembles another. We typically think of them resembling them visually, but actually you can also get mimicry, what we call olfactory mimicry, so where something smells like something else, or behavioral mimicry, where something behaves like something else. So this can happen for a number of different reasons, but the specific form of mimicry I'm interested in is called Batesian mimicry, named after a 19th century naturalist, as is often the case. And in Batesian mimicry, you have a harmless or palatable prey species, which has evolved to resemble a species that is defended in some way against predators, maybe with a toxin or some spines or something like that.
So so these animals look like they have a range of defenses or look like they could sting or bite you, but they don't. Can you give me an example of some of these different types of characters across the natural kingdom?
Yeah, so I'm going to talk a lot about hoverflies and wasps, I think, because that's what this particular piece of research is about. And we all know that wasps are nasty and can sting you. Actually, they're not that nasty. They're actually really kind of interesting and useful creatures. But hoverflies are completely harmless. And if you're a predator like a bird, a tasty snack. But hoverflies resemble wasps, and therein lies the confusion. And that's where the mimicry lies. But yeah, other species, you know, we see this in, for example, snakes. So you have highly venomous snakes, like coral snakes, which, you know, could kill a human if they were to bite you. But then you have harmless snakes that mimic the same colour patterns and look very similar and can confuse humans or predators, even though they don't have those venoms to defend themselves. And then like at the other end of the spectrum, there are even plants that do this. So we're all used to stinging nettles. We try to avoid them, unpleasant sting that you get if you don't avoid them. But you might not have noticed dead nettles, which are very similar, and yet they don't sting you, but they benefit from the mimicry because herbivores and humans avoid treading on them or eating them.
Is this the same thing where you see eye patterns on the backs of birds or moths? Is that Batesian mimicry, or is that a different type of mimicry?
So that's slightly different. Yeah, there's a range of different closely related phenomena where in all cases the prey species is trying to fool the predator in some way. Mm. But we tend to distinguish, I mean, something like, you know, eye spots on a peacock butterfly, for example, they're potentially scary to a predator because they make the butterfly maybe look like a larger species, for example, but they aren't necessarily advertising a defense as such. They, in the case of if you see a big pair of eyes on butterfly wings staring back at you, you might think, oh, this is actually a large species that might eat me, rather than a defended prey species. So, yeah, there are several distinctions there. You know, you also get prey species which resemble parts of the environment. Either they might be masquerading, as we say, as a twig or something, if they're a caterpillar, or they might be simply camouflaged, cryptic, hiding in plain sight.
So let's talk about your work then, which is in Batesian mimicry, which is essentially where a species looks just like a dangerous species and benefits from that potential threat because they're treated differently because of the resemblance. People assume that they are or predators might assume that they are the same species. How does this work? How does a species evolve to look like a completely, I mean, what I'm right in saying, hoverflies are very different species to wasps.
Yeah, exactly. There's a you know, millions of years separating the evolutionary origins of flies and wasps, and there are loads of different types of flies, and most of them are not wasp-like in any respect. And so in essence, you've put your finger on the question that drives us, which is, how did evolution get here? How did this happen? Why does it happen? And why does it happen in some species and not in others? So if you look at hoverflies, you find that a bunch of hoverflies are mimetic. Some of them are they mimic wasps, some mimic bees, honeybees or bumblebees. You even get hoverfly species, amazingly, where different individuals in the same population resemble different species of bumblebee.
What?
So species I work on are so-called polymorphic species. In other words, has different forms. You have a red-tailed fly, which has a furry red bum and a black abdomen. And then you have another form, which has a white tail and a yellow abdomen. And those two flies can mate with each other and have babies, but they're the same species, but they resemble completely different species of bumblebee.
So these are the same individuals are in the same species, and it isn't a male-female difference in shape or color. That I didn't know that was possible.
Yeah, well, so it is pretty crazy. And in fact, it's relatively unusual. There are several hoverfly species that do this.
Wow. And it
really gives us actually a really crucial tool to start unpicking that question you asked, which is, well, why did this happen? Why did mimicry evolve? And the specific subject of our research in the paper we're talking about today is not just why did mimicry evolve, but why is it really good in some places and not so good in others? So if you look at hoverflies, some hoverflies are exquisite replicas of wasps, for example, which, you know, even a trained entomologist can get confused. I famously put a figure in a paper I published once of a hoverfly thinking it was a bee when it wasn't a bee. It was actually a hoverfly. Quite embarrassing for me as a professional entomologist. But then there are other species which, you know, even, you know, an untrained child would from 10 paces would probably spot that kind of looks a bit like a wasp, but it isn't a wasp, is it?
Right.
So the question we're homing in on in our paper in particular is why are some species so rubbish? Why are some species making themselves conspicuous? They've got these bright black and yellow patterns. They're sort of shouting to the predator, here I am. And I'm a bit like a wasp, but, you know, it doesn't take very long to work out that I'm not a wasp and therefore I'm a tasty snack. It doesn't seem to make any sense. And so by investigating that question, we're asking a whole set of questions about how evolution works.
Is it, I mean, this sounds like a really simple, but it's probably very wrong suggestion. Is it possible that they're just in a different stage of their evolutionary journey? If we gave them enough time and rolled the tape on fast enough, they would eventually, through evolution, become much more like the animal they're mimicking, or is that not the case?
No, that is definitely a plausible hypothesis. It's one of the often cited hypotheses. The nice thing about this problem is it's got a whole range of very plausible solutions, and we don't have a lot of evidence for any of them. So, hence the experiments we've been doing. But it's a question that generates lots of cool possibilities. And the one that you've put your finger on there, the idea that evolution is not a static thing, it's a dynamic process going on all the time. And of course, it's going on in a changing environment. So you potentially have this, what people describe as a Red Queen situation, which comes from, you know, Lewis Carroll, where you have a species constantly running to keep up with an evolutionary target. So if, for example, you're a hoverfly and you're trying to look like a wasp, you might be gradually evolving to become more wasp-like. But if the wasp is busily evolving away because it doesn't want to be resembled by you because it dilutes the message that it's trying to give predators, then you could have a sort of a stable equilibrium at which the hoverfly never looks entirely
right.
like a wasp because it's always running to keep up. Yeah.
I'm also wondering, is it possible that you don't need to look exactly like the species you are trying to mimic? You only need to look a little bit like it for the effect to work. I mean, I remember this extraordinary interview we did on the program. It must have been 10 years ago. It's a TV show that they did. I think it was Channel 4. And what they did is they created these traps and lures and sort of fake animals, And all they did is they used really shorthand analogs for the animals. So in one case, they showed, I think it was a type of monkey. They showed just, there was just a, it was like a cloth monkey, very clearly nothing that would fool any animal. But they put the very specific color of this monkey's bum on it. And for some reason, the monkey thought that was enough to trick the monkey into thinking, well, this is obviously a monkey and it cared for it and it tried to nourish it and all that sort of stuff. The triggers that tell animals, oh, this is one of my own, it turns out they're not as complicated as we might think. That, you know, you sometimes these animals in the wild trying to mate with, you know, discarded bottles, you know, that sort of thing. There's something about the shape or the color that is exactly the right color that they're looking for. Is it possible that these hoverflies only need to be a little bit like a wasp for their predators to go, oh, that must be a wasp. It's got that thing that is dangerous.
Yeah, and you've identified two different hypotheses there. One is that, yeah, like you say, that being approximately waspish is enough. And the other is that some parts of the waspishness might matter more than others. I mean, in the case of your monkey, it might have been the colour of its bum or something. And that might be true in hoverflies as well. Maybe matching the colour of a wasp is more important than matching the pattern or the size or the shape. So, in terms of, you know, how good is good enough, we know from the way that humans respond to hoverflies, often humans are fooled even by a fly which I think looks quite different from a wasp. Levels of expertise vary a lot, and also things like color perception and cognition even within the human species vary. And then as soon as you start looking at other species, the kinds of predators that attack flies, you know, might vary from really quite intelligent birds with very good color vision through to spiders or praying mantises, which have relatively poor vision and relatively, you know, simple brains. And so you could expect that depending on which predators are important, the level of accuracy you need might vary.
In your work, you used life-size 3D printed insect models. What did you make them for and what did you learn from that study?
Yeah, okay, so the big problem with being an evolutionary biologist is you're trying to study a process that happens over time and typically over many generations, in other words, thousands or millions of years even. But you're trying to do it from the here and now. So we kind of constantly wish we had a time machine. What the 3D printing technology allows us to do in a way is recreate evolutionary scenes from the past. We can create organisms that don't currently exist, but might have existed in the past, or indeed might exist in the future. We can imagine what an evolutionary trajectory might look like. And then we can ask present day predators what they think of those forms. So that's what we were up to with these with this 3D printing technique.
So you made 3D printed insect models that were what, somewhere in between the a hoverfly that doesn't look anything like a wasp and a hoverfly that looked just like a wasp, and you then tried to see which ones fooled the predators?
Yeah, that's basic. That's the sort of basic design of our experiment. So we actually start with a fly that isn't a mimic at all, a fly that an ordinary looking housefly type thing. And then we use a combination of technology. So we have really high resolution 3D photography, which allows us to capture a full 3D model of a fly and at the other end of the spectrum, a wasp. And then we use some clever mathematics and morphing technology to create intermediate 3D models in a computer between a fly and a wasp. So we can make something that is exactly 50% fly, 50% wasp, or 75% wasp, whatever. And then the thing that's really only been possible in the last 5 to 10 years is 3D manufacturing, 3D printing, a full color life-size plastic model of this 3D image that we've constructed.
That is so cool. Created these, what was the result of the study when you showed these to birds and spiders? What did they do?
Yeah, so with the first basic experiments we did was asking that question, how accurate is accurate enough? And we did that with wild great tits, and the great tits were phenomenally good at telling the difference between a mimic that is near perfect and the real thing, the real wasp. I'd say they were better than humans. So, I mean, quite a lot better by the looks of it. And that's when I say humans, I'm talking about us in the lab. We used to get the models confused in the lab when we were printing them. So we ended up having to print a code on the bottom so we didn't get mixed up. Whereas the birds, they could tell them apart really easily. But then when we switched to looking at invertebrate predators like spiders and praying mantises, we found that the level of accuracy required was reduced. So that would suggest that your kind of explanation for imperfect mimicry being, well, kind of approximate is good enough, that explanation won't work if the real predators that matter are birds, but it would work if the real predators that matter are invertebrates like spiders and mantises. And of course, the next research question is, well, which predators are important? And actually, we're busy working on that at the moment. We don't know for sure.
The birds themselves and the spiders, they did actually, I mean, even though it was an inanimate object and made of presumably plastic, they still saw it as something edible. Did they? They were fooled by the structure enough to want to eat it.
Well, we did slightly different designs with different predators. So with the birds, what we did was we trained them because they're pretty clever beasts. They pretty rapidly work out that's a piece of plastic I can't eat.
Yeah.
But what you can do is you can train them to associate the plastic model with a mealworm reward that you give them in a little dish below the model. So we had the birds flipping lids of dishes to get access to mealworms. And the cue they were using to know whether or not there was a mealworm present was, is that a wasp on top of the dish or is it a fly?
I'm very clever. Okay. Because I was worried. Whereas, I was thinking about these poor birds eating plastic flies.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, so unfortunately, the spiders and the mantises got a bit of a raw deal because we animated the 3D models on a little robot arm, and the spiders and mantises did indeed think that this was a real dinner, and they would jump on it and try and eat it and discover after, you know, with some frustration that they couldn't actually munch it.
Wow. God, it's mad, isn't it? I love the show because you end up speaking to researchers who are doing the craziest things. And probably you say, well, I work in science. Most people go, oh, well, you work in evolutionary biology. Okay, that's interesting. And they don't ask the next 10 questions to get to that. That is crazy. Really interesting speaking with you. Dr. Tom Reeder is from the University of Nottingham talking about Batesian mimicry. Thanks, Tom.
Hey, thanks, Jonathan.
Well, I thought that was really interesting. I'd love to hear from you, and particularly if you've ever been out in the wild and spotted an animal that has camouflaged itself or mimicked really well. Love to hear those stories. We were out in the garden yesterday and we saw this stick insect kind of moth thing, and it looked so convincing as a leaf. And it was only when you went up really, really close, it flew away. Love to hear your stories of those. If you manage to see something really exotic, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. That's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to Marais O'Sullivan, Simon Keane, Rory Galvin, and Hugo da Silva. Scott was on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on Newstalk.